Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 70, titled Tolerant Patience. What is it?
Shantideva is quite amazing. I am, before I turn to compassion, just to add a little about patience or tolerance. I somehow like that word for pain, but I can never decide. In the old English language, moralists and the translations of people like Seneca, the Stoics, and people like that, patience is definitely the right word, no question. But in the modern period, patience, people have kind of the idea like, I'll get you later. I'll be patient and I'll get back my enemy later. You know, it's like waiting for the opportunity. You know, it has a very strong connotation like that. Be patient, you know, you'll get your chance, you know. Whereas this one is basically the antidote of anger and rage and hatred is this tolerance, you know. And but if you use one, then you can use the other one in describing the different types. If you say patience, you can say tolerant patience. You can say insightful patience. You can say forgiving patience. It's sort of where the forgiveness teaching comes in Buddhism, is the highest form of patience, where, you know, you don't want to take revenge on anybody for any harm that they've done. And actually, even it's so extreme, Shantideva, that you would rather die than hate someone who is trying to kill you, actually. I mean, that doesn't mean you wouldn't defend yourself not to be killed or try to prevent them from killing you. But you wouldn't hate them for wanting to kill you. You wouldn't angrily defend yourself. You know, like a martial artist, you know, the great martial artists, they feel if they get angry in fighting back, you know, or evading the violence of someone coming at them, then they will lose. They'll lose their balance. They'll be exhausted and so forth. So the secret of the high proficiency of martial arts is to stay cool. Even the tiger is jumping on you or the enemy is jumping on you. You're more powerful. You can be more powerful by using the energy that way. So I like that. And I just, if I can add one thing, because I often do this, particularly in our culture with women, because women are socialized to be tolerant, and men are socialized to react aggressively to even the slightest stepping on the toe. And then women either can internalize that tolerance in such a way as to become ill internally, or they blow up like out of total control after a long period of abuse. And neither of which are successful or good for them. So one of Shantideva's brilliant things that I really like is where he says that what makes you angry or intolerant is when you see something happening that you feel shouldn't be happening, and or you see something that you feel should be happening being prevented from happening, being blocked. And so Shantideva says that he has a great verse that we like very much, which he says, you had the translation there. He said, why be upset about something if you can do something about it? Do something about it. And if you can't do anything about it, why be upset about it? He has such two different premises in the same final line in this one four-line verse, right? So what this, I feel, signals is, and this is the skill that women should cultivate and develop through mindfulness, which is, and then he has this other thing, the fuel of anger, intolerance, is frustration. You know, what he calls yimideva, you know, mental discomfort. You know, and we use that in English a lot now in America. I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not comfortable with the way Trump talks, you know. I'm not comfortable with the other thing we say. Well, I'm comfortable with that, we say, you know, like that. So discomfort, mental discomfort, is the fuel of anger. He says, so therefore, don't ever be this uncomfortable. Don't let that fuel build up. Don't let frustration build. So that means act forcefully to make something happen you want to have happen, or to prevent something from happening that you don't want to happen before it makes you mad. Don't sit and tolerate and nurse the frustration, because you're socialized as women to let the guys rattle on and on with some idiotic nonsense and do this, but get in there really quickly. And I'll give an example. Nanette's here. Usually I don't like to do it. She gets angry when I do this at me, scolds me, doesn't get angry, scolds me. But for example, I would come home from the office and somebody in the, you know, the department, like Henry Kissinger said, academic politics is so amazing, it's so vicious because the stakes are so low. Was one good thing Henry Kissinger said. Bernie should take appreciation of that. And so I would come home very irritated, angry with some moronic things somebody in the department did, spoiling everything for the students and them. And I'd come and say to Nina, "You know what just happened?" And she would say, "Well, why don't you shut up about it before we're both upset?" And then that would make me more mad. "Why are you not listening to me?" And then, for a few times, you know. And then I would realize, wait a minute, that's right. So then, you know, I'd up-level it, as we used to say, or drop out of it and leave it outside. And then, you know, get involved with the children of the evening or whatever it is we're going to do. And then eventually the story will come out in a calm manner when I'm no longer upset, you know, and if it's worth anything. So that's the kind of thing that people are, women particularly, are not socialized to do. And therefore they live with a lot of frustration and in our culture, and they should be standing up and doing something about it sooner. And but it takes the kind of mindfulness to recognize. And then lately I've come to see, I think, that's how the British Empire happened. The British Empire occurred by people dishing out a cup of tea when they were just before killing each other. At least within the English, of course, they were terribly racist and they were horrible, genocidal, and different people, the Anglo forebears. But that thing of the cup of tea, like sort of sidetracking the sort of mounting, escalating conflicts, I think is really, really brilliant. You know? Right? Don't you think? So, be forceful when you're still able to do it skillfully and humorously, because then the style that you deliver, the critique of the moron male who is annoying you, will be such that they might even learn to appreciate it. Gradually. Takes time, I think, often. Anyway, okay, I'm sorry, I just want to add that.
No.
Which, because of having experienced, you know, domestic life and appreciating Shantideva, who's really great. Also, Atisha, just mentioned Atisha. He was always bugged by the king of Tibet, the nobleman of Tibet, when he went there to give him marriage counseling. And they said, "Atisha is such a great teacher. How about some marriage counseling?" And you know, and then about the Tibetan women are very strong, minded, and so on. So then he would say, "I don't do that. I'm a monk. You know, I'm a bhikshu. I don't know about marriage counseling." And then finally, he got irritated by it. Constant repetition. And so one day, King of Tibet in the court there and said, "Like, how about some marriage counseling?" He said, "Okay, all right, here's some marriage counseling. You want marriage counseling? Yes. Okay, here it is. Husband and wife, each of them will soon be dead. Therefore, while still alive, they should be more kind to each other." So that's really a good one, I think. Because, you know, otherwise religion, you know, has the idea, women get the idea about religion that it's telling them to suppress themselves. You know, then they're going to get sick. So then they fall for the shrinks, the psycho guys, who tell them, "Get really mad, you know, punch a pillow and, like, leave your partner and do all this." And neither extreme is that is good. Best is, be really forceful and stand up for everything, what you see should be right. And help the guys out of the wrecking of the world that they're currently doing. Help them do that before it gets you mad. Before you're too long nursing frustration. Right? Okay. All right.
I'll remember that next
what's
time.
What's that?
I'll remember those two lines next time somebody asks me for marriage counseling. I'll try that.
Right. Very good. So, okay. So now we're going to go look at the compassion issue. Now, there are two... In the Tibetan tradition, there are two major precepts, what are called, like, you know, the personal instruction traditions. You know, some people go crazy about it. It's ear whispered, you know, like secret esoteric. That's nonsense. It's just person to person. And there's, you know, one of the greatnesses of Tibet is that not only they preserve the institutions of the monastic sangha, you know, community of male, not so well the female monastics, but the male ones. Because by the time it went to Tibet, the female one had been very weakened in India. So, but anyway, they preserved that institution and the curriculum of the great monastic universities of India. But they also, the personal transmission of the oral traditions and the person-to-person instructions, they preserved also. And so a person like His Holiness the Dalai Lama combines in himself. Atisha brought to Tibet these traditions. Actually, he went here to Indonesia to get the tradition of the great compassion, which he was in Bodh Gaya one day. Since you bring up Atisha, there's so many great stories about him. He was in Bodh Gaya and he was circumambulating the great stupa on pilgrimage. And he was saying mantras, you know, Mani Padme Hum and so on. And there was a statue on the wall of the thing that she used to talk to some selected people of Tara. So he's just doing this bowing to the stupa, the tree of enlightenment. And then he hears this voice, he looks up, and there's Tara statue speaking, looking kind of annoyed with him and saying, "That's great, Atisha, you're doing all this pilgrimage and you're doing all kind of meritorious things, but why don't you practice Buddhism?" And he said, "What do you mean? I'm doing pilgrimage and I'm saying mantras and, you know, I'm feeling devoted. Yeah, I know that's all great, but how about practicing Buddhism?" So he said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, the real practice of Buddhism is the spirit of enlightenment, of love and compassion. The bodhisattva attitude that you referred to at the beginning of the talk, where you switch your mind from the habit, the addictive habit of thinking about what you're getting out of everything all the time. You know, which we do. Like, well, today what I do, I go on the bus or I go shopping, what's the best thing for me to do? We always think that we're addicted to that kind of what's called self-preoccupation or self-cherishing. And switch that and think about what other people need. And, you know, and then that leads to this bodhisattva vow, bodhisattva will, bodhisattva inspiration, where one says, I want to make everybody else happy. What is it they need now? What do they want? What do they? And completely focus on that. And forgetting about yourself, which has this strange, ironic thing in the Buddhist psychology, as His Holiness is the absolute peerless person to explain, which is that the first person you make happy when you switch from thinking about your own happiness to others' happiness as your primary focus, other preoccupation, the first person you successfully make happy is yourself. Because the one way to guarantee your misery is to think about how happy you are. Oh, is this good enough? Could it be better some other way? Let me go to another restaurant, or let me try that, or whatever. The one way to doom yourself to constant dissatisfaction is to constantly reflect on how satisfied you are, because it'll never be good enough, ever. So one virtue of thinking about others, what makes them happy, is there's so many of them and they're so miserable that you don't have time to think about how satisfied you are, and that makes you feel better right away. You sort of lose yourself in thinking of the vast happiness in the minds and the nervous systems and the attitudes of other beings. And that's the point. That's what the medicine, the moonrise, sunrise, you know, Buddhism in its universal ability to rationalize everything. You look out the window in the morning and it's raining. Oh, great, it's the rainfall of the Dharma. Wonderful, thank you, Buddha. Sun is shining. Oh, it's the sunshine of the Dharma. It's hot. Oh, it's the heat of the Dharma. It's cold. Oh, it's the cool of the Dharma. Whatever it is, you can make some great grain out of it.